Blog Talk Radio.
This is an Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash production.
Into another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy radio show live here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash and live on our YouTube channel. Shout out to everyone stopping in here on Comical Sports over on our YouTube. Hope y'all are having an amazing, fantabulous day so far. And we've got a great show planned for you today. Little slow in the sports world. I could talk about Frank Ragnow signing a contract extension, but that's the gist they just made over on Comical Sports Memes, which you can check out right now. As the joke I was just making, no one really knows Frank Ragnow that well. Best center in the league, highest paid lineman in NFL history, but nobody really knows him that well. 90% of people wouldn't be able to recognize him if he walked into a restaurant. So that's the news of the day in the NFL. We may not come back around to that, but it's just a slow day in general. Just desperately, desperately waiting for the NBA playoffs to roll around. But we do have a fun Pacers story that we'll get to at some point today. NFL is now in the doldrums of May, week removed from the draft. And draft talk is only fun when you get to do it with someone else. I am definitely burned out from the NFL draft, and draft talk is fun when other people get to partake in the draft talk with you. So just waiting the 2 weeks for the NBA, NFL goes into the waiting period or the waiting game until training camp. All that fun surpasses, and we are left with baseball, and as of yesterday, soccer. And if you want just an extra reason why I hate soccer, we could start with the fact that during the broadcast yesterday, I wanted to talk about the Champions League semifinal between Chelsea and Real Madrid. And Chelsea ended up winning live on our air. And, of course, while I was doing this, I was ignoring the fact that John Means, the opening day starter for the Baltimore Orioles, which I did not realize was a fact until just recently, threw a no-hitter while we were on the air. At the very least, he completed his no-hitter while we were on the air yesterday, and we pretty much just straight up ignored the idea of our buddy John Means throwing a no-hitter, even though it was live on our air. And soccer, you will never get your mentions here on the show again. Sorry, soccer. Tried to be nice, but let's wait until maybe the World Cup rolls around. Then we'll get soccer back in the mix of things. But as it stands right now, no for soccer. Soccer, you wasted our chance to call a no-hitter live on the air, which, to be honest, probably wouldn't have been that exciting, but would have been cool once, probably ever, probably as long as we're going to be on the air. That's probably the only time we're going to catch a no-hitter live on our airwaves. So, you know what? So be it. We'll enjoy it as it stands. Thanks to everyone checking in here on YouTube, and for all of you listening on Blog Talk, thanks for stopping in here today. Well, and to start off the show, since we're going to talk some baseball here today, I want to do this the way that I envision, like, the future of baseball broadcasts. And I am a huge baseball fan. I know that that's something that is less and less nowadays, especially from someone who's 19 going on 20 to be a avid baseball fan. But baseball got me at a young age, and baseball will always have me, at least until something else comes up in my life that makes it like I want to prioritize that over baseball. Baseball's got me. They're really fun. Their playoffs are really fun. The NHL playoffs, I think, start this week, so that's another reason to get excited. The playoffs for the NHL start next Tuesday. Yeah, next Tuesday is the start of the NHL playoffs. And so that should be fun to watch. And baseball is kind of like dominating this week. There's no, like, exciting Padres game or anything. They just finished with the Pirates, and they don't play today. I'm a San Diego Padres fan, for those who may or may not have been aware. But it's still fun to watch it play out over the next few days. And what's interesting about baseball is just the fact that you are left with a lot of games that, like, don't matter, but this Astros-Yankees series very much does matter. So the future I have envisioned of the talk show, like the talk show baseball broadcast, is that the game is like the background, and they did this with a mega cast of the college football season, like at the beginning of the year. Like, do a mega cast, but have it such that like a talk show is going on during the game, and the game is like something in the background as Carlos Correa grounds the ball to third base, Urshela over to, I think that's Ford. Is Ford the first baseman? Yep, Mike Ford, and out number one. That's actually a Tyler Wade who's making the play. But, like, the Yankees and Astros are in the ninth inning right now. It's a game that matters because of the two best teams in the American League, not by record, but by they have the two best teams on paper. And they're finishing up a series, which was passionate for Yankees fans, even though they didn't sell out the Tuesday game or probably this Wednesday, or sell out the Wednesday game and probably not the Thursday game. But still, it's going to be interesting to see these two teams play each other because there's that animosity. The Astros are the big brothers and the Yankees are the little brothers. And for people who think that that sounds a little bit weird, but like, you know, the Yankees are the little brothers to the Astros, the context is that in 2015, the Astros beat the Yankees in the one-game wild card. In 2017, they met in the American League Championship Series. They didn't play in 2016. In 2016, the Yankees missed the playoffs. In 2017, the Yankees and Astros met in the ALCS. It went seven games, and then the Astros blanked the Yankees in Game 7 to advance to the World Series and ultimately win against the Dodgers in seven games in the series that, in hindsight, people believe the Astros cheated their way to the championship. And there's irrefutable evidence that they stole signs with technology, but I attest that that's not cheating because the rule books don't explicitly stipulate where the line is crossed and what punishment shall be taken. Therefore, baseball is just governing on public relations. And to be honest, I have no problem with the idea of technologically stealing signs. It's going to push baseball to innovate and adapt instead of punishing the cheaters. You just got to find ways to legislate that out. And it's a complex thing, and I'm not doing the best job of explaining it because we're live on radio right now, and I'm also watching Kyle Tucker bat against Justin Wilson in the ninth inning. But at the same time, just so that happens, and then 2018, the Astros lose to the Red Sox, and the Yankees lose to the Red Sox, and then 2019, the Astros have their murderer's mile, which is like the fourth best offensive lineup in the history of baseball, play the Yankees in the ALCS, dominate the series pretty much all the way through, as it's ball four to Kyle Tucker. They dominate the series pretty much all the way through, and the Astros end up hitting a walk-off homer Game 6 to go to the World Series. They lose to the Nationals, but it was still an epic, epic game. I still will remember where I am from that forever. And so 2020 comes around, and both teams lose to the Tampa Bay Rays. And so for the past half decade, baseball has been you go through the Astros and you go through the Yankees to get to the World Series. Either the Yankees make the World Series, the Astros make the World Series, or you have to beat the Astros and the Yankees to get to the World Series. And I look at the teams on paper, and they still look to be in the same position, that it's about making the World Series, if you're the Astros and Yankees, all about making the World Series this year and having the best teams on paper, in part because the American League can't get their bleep together. even though Chaz McCormick is hitting in big spots for the Astros. I know he is a pinch hitter, but still, Chaz McCormick is hitting big time for the Astros, and that makes me laugh a little bit at the Houston Astros. So Astros and Yankees go on, and they're this big rivalry, and they've dominated baseball for a half decade, and they're the two teams. But if we're being honest, this talk show idea is like the game being on in the background, and then you're talking about the game itself. And so there's a lot of animosity, and it's exciting to watch the Astros and the Yankees. And baseball puts these interesting series at just the right times, and I think they do a good job at knowing when to pick and choose the times to put their best games in relation to the schedule with regards to the NFL draft, in regards to the NBA playoffs, whatever it may be. They're very good at putting good matchups at good times. They did it for this Astros-Yankees series, even though it's, you know, during a weekday. It's something that got me interested. I talked about this on the podcast, but I sat down and I watched Astros-Yankees. I didn't watch it yesterday, but I'm here watching the ninth inning of today's game live on the Take It Easy radio show and just calling the game. And so you have, you know, 1-2 to Chaz McCormick and rung him up on a pitch inside. Probably should have been ball four, but strikeout and two down here for the New York Yankees, who are going to have one more crack to hit a walk-off here. So it's an interesting series that was put at just the right time. And so this is the idea that I like. It's a radio show and a talk show during games. And it's my envisioning of the future for what sports broadcast can be like. Have a talk show, bring some guests on, talk to people in the game. Just have the game not be the central focus of the talk show. Just have conversation and the game going on in the background, where, like, if you're doing a mega cast for the national championship game of college football, and you just look up one moment, you're like, oh, shit, Jalen, oh bleep, Jalen Hurts isn't, sorry, I forgot about that. Oh, bleep, on the podcast, you can say everything but the F word. Oh, bleep, Jalen Hurts is now out of the game, and Tua Tagovailoa has just gone in for Alabama, kind of thing. So That's the idea of a talk show baseball show, as Martin Maldonado takes the 0-1 up high for a 1-1 count. And so the game is kind of the background to the broadcast. And this is a perfect segue on the broadcast, because the Yankees will have Brett Gardner, the nine-hitter, DJ LeMahieu, 2-for-3 on the day, and Giancarlo Stanton up in the ninth. And Giancarlo Stanton is one of the most fascinating players in baseball, as Martin Maldonado just crushes it deep down the left field line, about 20 rows back. That is a home run for the Houston Astros. Just pummeled a two-run home run to left field, and that chance for Giancarlo Stanton may have just disappeared, as it goes from being 5-4 to 7-4. Houston Astros out in front. Whew, that one was crushed by our boy Martin Maldonado, and the Astros have now come back from down 3-1 and scored 6 runs in the final 3 innings, like the Astros do. So that one was a tank by Martin Maldonado. So I was talking about Giancarlo Stanton, and Giancarlo Stanton is interesting because he's the best DH in baseball. Nobody can do what Giancarlo Stanton does. And to be honest, injuries and other stuff is the reason why Giancarlo Stanton has never quite been able to put everything together in his career. Giancarlo Stanton has had a great career so far, and Giancarlo Stanton finds himself in an interesting place with his career because he's never had the help except for the season in his prime where he hit the 60 home runs. And that was almost, let's see, 4 seasons ago now. So he was on the Yankees in 18, 19, 20, and 21. And this year he's been healthy for the entire first 6 weeks of the season, which is a big deal, as Jose Altuve flies out to right field and ends the inning. The Yankees will get one more shot here to try and win the game. But Stanton has been remarkably healthy this year, and it leads some to think that this might be the year he gets to 45 homers or 50 homers or matches that production. And 2018, so his first year with the Yankees, Giancarlo Stanton looks something like he did in 2017 when he won the MVP and hit 60 homers. And since then, it's just been, how can he get on the field? Can Giancarlo Stanton get on the field? And so this is the interesting thing that the Yankees have tried to kind of figure out is, when healthy, what's the best way to use him? And I think that they figured out that if they want to put Judge at the two spot and Stanton at the three, that's a possibility. But something they've gone to recently is flipping those two around, where Stanton, who's hitting much better than Aaron Judge, get hit second and Judge hits third. Because statistically, since they're at the top of the lineup, it's about, over a long season, I think something like 20 more at-bats by being the two-hitter instead of the three-hitter. And this is the way that baseball has changed, is that the archaic idea of having your best hitter as your three-hitter is starting to go away. And having your best power hitter is often the guy who gets on base the most. And so putting that guy second in the order is starting to become a strategy, as well as putting him first sometimes. The Angels tried Mike Trout in the leadoff spot. The Dodgers, obviously, and Red Sox put Mookie Betts as a leadoff hitter, as a true leadoff guy. The Padres have gone both ways with Fernando Tatis. Nolan Arenado has hit in the two spot before. So it's an experiment with if you have your best power hitter being your best average hitter, and they're just the best hitter on the team, where do you put him in the lineup? And it's changed because baseball has changed so much in the last 5 years. And I know that's counter to what most people think, but the aesthetic of the game and the way numbers are trained in the game, baseball has changed from it's almost an entirely different game from just 5 years ago, nonetheless 10 years ago. Analytics have changed baseball just as much as the NBA, where the game is close to unrecognizable, and football changes right in front of your eyes as people adapt and change and figure out new and better ways to go about these different things. And so what's fascinating is you are left with a new product and new ways to take advantage of it. And having Stanton, this gigantic hitter, who in all of baseball, nobody can do what Giancarlo Stanton does. Giancarlo Stanton is a monster when he steps up to bat. Nobody can do exactly what Giancarlo Stanton can do just because he's 260 pounds. He looks like he's holding a twig when he swings, and the torque that he puts on his body is a different kind than Fernando Tatis, where a lot of his power from a small guy is generated legs to hips, not necessarily like Stanton, where it's just the velocity and torque of the bat makes it such that Giancarlo Stanton has hit 18 balls over 115 miles an hour this year, and then the next closest is Judge with like three. So it's like 18 to three is the next closest. And Stanton is the perfect player for the modern MLB of, you know, bat speed and torque, and not launch angle, but the velocity and angle at which the ball comes off the bat. And Brett Gardner singles the center field to get the rally going for the Yankees. 185 hitter gets a single in the ninth, and all of a sudden you start rolling a little bit. So Brett Gardner whacks a single up the middle. This is another thing. I was talking about how baseball is changing. A lot of times those balls whacked up the middle, I anticipate them being hits, and then I look up and, nope, it's a line out to shortstop, or it's a line out to second, where for my entire history of watching baseball, I'm anticipating that that baseball is going to be a base hit, and hit right at the guy for a double play. That's the way shifts on every batter have changed the aesthetic of baseball. I love it. Other people, traditionalism doesn't, but I love the shifts, and I love the you know, Stanton rocketing home runs, which he would have done either way because he's just a gigantic human being, but the idea that it's encouraging more Stantons and more Judges, and DJ LeMahieu to try and hit 30 homers a year, even though this year LeMahieu's OPS is way down, and he's not walking as much as he used to. But it's still encouraging it to go his way, and LeMahieu got his last big contract is another big part, and the Yankees might have messed up on that contract with LeMahieu. Time will tell, but they might have messed up on LeMahieu's contract as DJ swings and misses to make it a 1-2 count on a closer, Ryan Pressly. I guess he's technically the closer now for the Astros. But anyways, when it comes to Stanton, it's just cool that they're now incentivizing him, and he's been healthy this year, and 4 years removed from the 60-homer MVP season, Stanton still looks like the crazy power hitter that just literally made my jaw drop in 2017. And it's been a while because he's never always healthy. I think in the last few years, Stanton's only played a few games here and there. I don't think he's played more than 80. Well, last year, obviously. But last year, I think he only played like 30-something. But in the year before that, I think he only played in like 60 games. And, you know, he got to 160 with the Marlins, and he got close to that in, I think, 2 years after, or the next year, 2018, as the Mancube strikes out on a 2-2 count, bringing up Mr. Giancarlo Stanton. And it's been interesting to see him hit close to 1,000 OPS again and put it all together, because when Stanton hits the ball, it just looks different than everyone else. And so I think it's cool that Stanton finds himself back in this position where he can stay healthy. They're putting him in the two slot of the order. He's second in the league with 9 home runs this year, which would put him on pace to hit 45 or 50. So I think it's cool that Giancarlo Stanton is back as he takes strike one down the middle. He could have whacked that one, but takes strike one right down the middle. And he can't win the game, though. Judge would have to do that coming up next. But Judge is hitting even lower than LeMahieu, but at least he hits for more power. He's got like 7 homers on the season, but that batting average is down. And Stanton swings and misses on the low and away pitch. Never had a chance at hitting it, and it's now 0-2 for Giancarlo Stanton. And this is the other part, is the strikeouts, right? Everyone talks about the strikeouts. But if Stanton hits a ground ball here, the game's over. And if he hits a fly out, the runner's still at first. So striking out's not the worst thing. When I was playing baseball, I used to think strikeouts were the end of the world. And I didn't realize that strikeouts are okay. It's okay to maybe hit for a little more torque and risk a strikeout as Stanton fouls off 97. He missed it up and in. I think he was aiming up and out, and he missed it up and in on Stanton. So keeps it at 0-2, tried to bury it in on the hands there. But I don't think it was a miss by Ryan Pressly. Not the worst thing in the world to strike out. It's something that I wish I'd learned back in the day, but not the worst thing in the world. Pressly sets up here on the crunch time move for Giancarlo Stanton. Stanton sitting back, 0-2 is the count. Pressly to Stanton. He rips it, diving south by Bregman. 1 on the first, 2, an amazing double play. And the Houston Astros win the game. Oh, my goodness. Ripped it to third, diving stop by Bregman, and they turned a ridiculous 5-4-3 double play. The Yankees lose, and the Astros win, and they finish off this series against the New York Yankees. All right. So let's talk here for a quick second about the breaking news of the day, Alberto Pujols. And Albert Pujols is gone. He is no longer on the Anaheim Angels. And I was stunned when I saw the news today, not because Albert Pujols is a great hitter. I was just surprised that the Angels were ready and just – they were ready to move off of Albert Pujols. And the Albert Pujols contract for the Angels is going to go down as one of the worst contracts in the history of Major League Baseball. Because right when Albert Pujols lands on the Anaheim Angels, he becomes a below-league average hitter, below-league average OPS. And from 2017 onward, he's below-league average in OPS, and Albert Pujols' career goes into the blank. And so the Angels ended up just upending and releasing him after 10 years. The contract did not age well. Albert Pujols has been a liability offensively since 2017, and Albert Pujols is not the player that they had thought they were getting when they got him. In fact, the Angels never really got one season of great Albert Pujols. A little bit in 2012, but after the first year, the Angels never really got great Albert Pujols again. And I was shocked when they just upended and released him today, because it was like this contract that we've been talking about for now a decade. I remember where I was when Albert Pujols signed with the Angels. I was a small child at home watching SportsCenter and flashing across that sidebar and seeing Albert Pujols signed a 12-year, $240 million contract with the Anaheim Angels. And I was floored because at the time I was rooting for Texas a little bit, and they had just gone to back-to-back World Series and lost to the Cardinals. And Albert Pujols was going to be this big money free agent going to the Anaheim Angels for 10 years, and he was going to be 41, even though, you know, there's some fudging of dates over in the Dominican Republic. So, you know, maybe Albert Pujols wasn't quite 31 when he signed with the Angels. But it was made out to be that Albert Pujols was going to be the last 10-year contract of a 30-year-old because those contracts don't age well. You can sign those long-term contracts to players when they're in their 20s, like a Manny Machado, like an Eric Hosmer, or Bryce Harper, or Nolan Arenado, or Giancarlo Stanton. You can sign those deals when they're in their 20s, but once people hit their 30s, it's not wise. And the only way you can get those contracts in your 20s is by getting to the majors fast and not doing what Albert Pujols did, which was sign another extension with the St. Louis Cardinals post his first contract. And so Albert Pujols reaches free agency, and Albert Pujols goes to the Angels, and he has one good season, and the rest becomes the worst contract. And to be fair, for guys in their 30s getting 10-year contracts, there was only one other contract of that sort. Well, really two, and both were handed out by Dave Dombrowski. There was the contract to Chris Sale recently and the contract to Miguel Cabrera. For guys in their 30s and not being a smart financial contract to give out. It was Chris Sale, and it was, I guess, David Price, too. We could throw David Price into the mix where that was not a great contract by Dave Dombrowski. Yeah, David Price was like 31 when he signed his big contract. Let's see how old Chris Sale was when he signed his big contract. Yeah, Chris Sale was 31 years old. No, Chris Sale was 30 years old when he signed his big contract with the Red Sox. So, all of them done by, so with the exception of Dave Dombrowski, everyone post-30 hasn't really gotten those contracts. It's him and it's Miguel Cabrera. Miguel Cabrera is in the exact same situation as Albert Pujols, where Albert Pujols' OPS has dipped from over 1,000 every year to 900 his last year in the Cardinals, and then the 895 the first year with the Angels, and after that, 760, 790, 787, 780, 672, where he had one of the worst wars in baseball, 700, 734, while playing a ton of games, by the way. He started in almost 150 games each of those seasons. Then 700, 734, 665, and then all the way down to now 622, and just being cut by the Anaheim Angels. And I think Albert Pujols will probably go to, like, the Marlins or something, but I was just stunned that the Angels just said, for a guy that they had celebrated his 3,000th hit because it was like a cool thing to have, and 600 home runs, it was just all of the limping their way to these career accolades that guaranteed a Hall of Fame that the Angels got to celebrate with Albert Pujols, which is only fun for the first couple of years. But after a while, it starts to wear thin a little bit, for sure. And Miguel Cabrera is kind of the same thing, because the story that we talked about before was that he almost got a bankruptcy for the Tigers once Mike Ilitch died. They got someone to end up taking over the team, but the amount of debt they had accrued, part of which came from the gigantic contract they owed Miguel Cabrera, ended up costing the organization mightily over the next couple of years. And Miguel Cabrera made an all-star team in the first couple of years of that contract, but since 2017, here is the OPS plus, or the OPS for Miguel Cabrera. So in 2017, dipped down to 7.828, then back up to 8.43, 7.44, 7.46, and now after his home run on opening day, he's hit one more home run and his OPS is down to 3.92, which is some people's batting average. But his on-base percentage is 179. Slugging is 2.13, and the Tigers still keep putting him in the lineup, because what else are you going to do? It's Miguel Cabrera, right? You're paying him all this money, so you might as well. But he's hitting below 100. He has an on-base percentage of 179, a slugging percentage of 213. And to be honest, I didn't even know it was possible to have a batting average be – or have an on-base percentage and an OPS be as low as Miguel Cabrera's is right now. After 17 games, nonetheless, but I didn't think it was possible to get that low at 392. And he's been a league average hitter for the last 5 seasons that they are paying 9 years and $270 million to. So it's not a great situation for the Tigers at this point. This is the tough situation that they fill up right now for the Detroit Tigers, where the economic uncertainty of, you know, baseball during COVID-19 and then Miguel Cabrera's contract is leaving the Tigers in limbo. And the Tigers have been terrible, terrible for years now. The Detroit Tigers have been a bad baseball team. And this is a limbo that they leave themselves in because they're spending so much money on Miguel Cabrera's contract. And they assume this debt, and that the new owner paid a lot of money to take over the team. And it's not a great situation for, you know, the Illich Holdings of Little Caesars and all that. They're just like, look, we don't really know what we're doing at this point. So the Sun takes over for the team, and the Tigers are kind of just hanging on by a thread at this point, if we're being honest. It's not a great situation for the Tigers to be in. And so the Detroit Tigers over the last few years have been the worst-run team in baseball. Or not the worst-run team, but they've had the worst record in baseball over the past few years. And it's a similar situation to the Angels, where the Angels are in the same position where they're spending so much money on losing seasons. And to compound everything, the Angels also have Mike Trout, which might be part of the incentive for why the Angels do what they do, which is, you know, make these moves like signing Ohtani, signing Anthony Rendon, trading for Justin Upton, trading for Zach Cozart, trading for Ian Kinsler. They put a lot of money into the team that's not ever any good. And the Tigers are in the same boat where, yeah, they had a tough year in 2015, and they gave that extension. And 2016, they turned it around and almost made the wild card. And since then, it's 98 losses, 114 losses. It would have been on pace for, let's see, 12 times 2.7, that's about 30 game difference. So they were on pace for 96 losses. So 98, 98, 114, which is 53 games out of first place, and then about 96. They were on pace to lose 100 games the next season. And they're getting some prospects. It's like a way to develop and make an investment there, but the Tigers are bad, and they're going to continue to be bad. They're really bad right now. Like, the Detroit Tigers have the worst record in baseball right now, I want to say. They've been a tire fire for years and years now. And, let's see, yeah, 9-22. Yeah, the Tigers have the worst record in baseball, and it's not even close. Because that team is really bad. I'm just trying to drive that point home. The Detroit Tigers are really bad, and they've been really bad for a lot of years now. And a lot of that has to do, or some of it has to do with Miguel Cabrera. Some of it has to do with the owner dying. It makes a lot, it's a poor combination of events for the Tigers. And they're going to suck, and they're going to get some top picks. And if they use them right, maybe they can have an Astros-style rebound. And to be honest, they're probably doing it better than everyone else because their organization has been so poorly run for a half decade now. And so the Tigers and Angels are in similar boats. And it's why I was stunned when it's just like, for half a decade now in baseball, we've been talking about Miguel Cabrera contract, Miguel Cabrera contract, Miguel Cabrera contract, Mike Trout contract, Miguel Cabrera contract. And now all of a sudden it's over. Like, they just dumped the contracts, and now they'll move on from those players. And it was shocking to see it play out the way it played out. It happened very quickly and without any promptness, without any prompt, like, advance, like any without any information in advance, we just dumped they dumped Albert Pujols, and that's it. That's the end of Albert Pujols as we know it on the Anaheim Angels. After a decade, 9 years of bad baseball, it's just over. All right, so let's talk a little bit about basketball. Because there's this interesting story that came out from the Pacers around Nate Bjorkgren, who is the head coach of the Indiana Pacers, and how the Pacers were pretty much done with Nate McMillan at the time. But Nate Bjorkgren came in as the coach. They passed on Mike D'Antoni. They took Nate Bjorkgren, and it seems like it's been a colossal failure for the Pacers. They wanted the Nick Nurse guy. They interviewed him and Chris Finch, both who were behind Nick Nurse, white guys, European basketball. It's really hard to find great white coaches in the NBA, but damn it, they will go to all lengths of the earth to try and find them. And so Nick Nurse is this innovative, fun coach, and you get Nate Bjorkgren, you get Chris Finch, and you start playing this game of how can we be the next Raptors? How can we get the next great white coach, quote unquote? So they fired Nate McMillan, who's done an awesome job in Atlanta, turning them into a contender. And Nate Bjorkgren takes over with the Pacers. And 1 year in, it looks like a pretty catastrophic failure, because one thing that they didn't account for, according to this article from Bleacher Report, is that they didn't really account for the idea that Nate Bjorkgren was going to be a bad personality fit. All they did was ask him about basketball. They just had his basketball nerdiness, and this is Jake Fisher, who is reporting this for Bleacher Report. They were infatuated with the basketball nerdiness. They were infatuated with him as being a coach and an X's and O's and an up-tempo style of play, but they didn't get the idea that he would be a little bit of a temper-flaring guy, someone who his aggression didn't match the discretion of, like, the infraction. And so this left the team in limbo that just wasn't sure, like, we don't really like this guy, and he's not a well-liked guy, and the Pacers kind of blew up, including the report that T.J. Warren may have opted for elective surgery to avoid coming back to Bjorkgren. And maybe the Pacers will get a do-over and hire Mike D'Antoni, but what's fascinating is that this could cost ownership. Not ownership. This could cost the front office in the eyes of ownership. It's that they were ready to move on from McMillan, who's a great coach, a boring coach, but a great coach. And they moved on from him, even though there were talks like the organization was like, had his voice had worn thin after like three consecutive first-round bounces. And they just weren't, if the voice of McMillan had worn thin and his perfect fit in Atlanta with a team that needed that kind of leadership, for the Indiana Pacers, it became a Bjorkgren basically mutiny, it looks like. And the Pacers might get to the play-in round and get bounced by the Hornets, but I think that's kind of what they want to move along here. And it could cost Kevin Pritchard his job, who's been there for a decade and built those old Blazers teams with Brandon Roy and Greg Oden and LaMarcus Aldridge, and then got fired and moved on to the Pacers, and then built the Pacers into what they were in 2014. And now it seems like maybe his stay has worn welcome, just like Nate McMillan's stay had worn welcome. And that's a tough pill to swallow if that's the way he's going to go out. Is after the Paul George trade, delay, 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 delay the inevitable as long as you can. And they did a good job at that for a while. Like after they traded him in 17, they made the playoffs, got bounced in the first round. Made the playoffs again, bounced in the first round, but lost Oladipo to injury. Oladipo comes back from injury. They go to the NBA bubble. They get the fourth seed and get bounced in the first round again. So the Pacers have been really good at delay, delay, delay the inevitable, which is they don't really have a superstar, which is not bad. Like, they've been all right for a while. And what's interesting is that The Pacers have been good for a while, and they've been delaying the fact that, like, hey, we don't really have a superstar. Like, we have Sabonis, he's a nice piece, he's an all-star, but we don't really have a superstar, and it's been delay, delay. And the Pacers have been interesting in that way. Maybe this conversation isn't as interesting as that to you, but I find it interesting that their strategy of let's delay the inevitable, delay the inevitable, delay the inevitable, and see where we get. And the Pacers did that, and they've made three straight first-round exits. And this year they're going to probably lose in the play-in round with an uninspired team. Caris LeVert is now the new Victor Oladipo, but they kind of are stuck in 9th and 10th seed purgatory. And they're going to get a draft pick, and they're going to add a nice little piece to go along with the rest of the team, whether it be, you know, another TJ Leaf or Aaron Holiday or Aaron Brooks or Justin Holiday, combine the two names there. But Aaron Holiday is probably just about it for them. It's Aaron Brooks or Justin Holiday or TJ McConnell or Doug McDermott. They're just going to find another plug-in guy. And so the Pacers are just kind of left in limbo at this point. It's going to be interesting to see where they go with a new coach, and maybe they're realistic about their identities, and Mike D'Antoni's realistic about their chances. And so it's going to be really interesting to watch the Indiana Pacers kind of like bottom out at some point. I don't know if that's going to be firing Pritchard now and just rebooting everything. I've talked before about, we've done a rebuilding series on the Pacers on the podcast, and I think it would be ideal for them to bottom out, trade Sabonis, trade Caris LeVert, just rebuild the entire franchise from scratch. Maybe you could build around Sabonis because he is a 25-year-old all-star and those don't come around as often, but if you get an offer you can't refuse on Sabonis, I wouldn't take it and let someone else kind of like retool and play the lottery game a little bit. See if he can get some of these top picks like the Bulls. Or I guess the Bulls aren't a good example because they always had like the 5th and the 6th and the 7th picks in the draft. But see if you can build something around Sabonis. And maybe that's going to involve shrewd drafting from the 12 position and being great about the guys you're drafting and how you want to build a fit to a team. But the way they're going to do that is without Nate Bjorkgren continuing to be the head coach. So that was an interesting story from today in the NBA. Matt Nagy just had a press conference where he talked about put Justin Fields in when he's not ready to start and ruin him. So they're going to, looks like they're going to wait to play Justin Fields. And the thing I find interesting about that is that if I feel like if you're drafting a first-round pick at quarterback, you should be able to start them right away, because what are the circumstances where in 3 weeks they're magically going to figure out that they're good enough to start? I don't feel like that's a thing that exists. Now, there may be examples of it and exceptions that prove my rule, but overall, it just feels like there aren't a lot of circumstances where a guy is magically going to get better by sitting on the bench. And people point to Patrick Mahomes and Aaron Rodgers, but those weren't necessarily situations where the team development was determined by that season. First of all, we have no idea what could have happened with Patrick Mahomes. And with Aaron Rodgers, that guy was the number one overall pick in his draft, who fell to 24, and everyone's like, are you insane? How could you keep passing on this guy? So the Packers had to take him because they were smart. And, or they got lucky, one of the two. But the thing with the Chiefs is, like, we're pretty sure it would have been the wrong move. Like, the Chiefs made the wrong move to not start Patrick Mahomes instead of Alex Smith. Like, people say he had a year to sit behind Alex Smith and learn. If I'm being honest, it looks like the first team rest certainly helped, but the Kansas City Chiefs made a mistake not putting Patrick Mahomes in his rookie season. And if you're not giving Justin Fields that full up, if the only argument that can be made around the Patrick Mahomes one, at least that I can think of, again, I have blind spots, but the only argument I think you can be made is, well, that whole offseason of first team reps in his second year was a huge help to Patrick Mahomes. And the way I look at it is like, well, you could give him those first team reps right after he got drafted. The second team reps might have helped, but just give him the first team reps and then let him go out and experiment a bit. If Justin Fields is going to be your franchise's future, why start Andy Dalton over him? It does not make sense. And this is the weird part. If even if you think future is way down the road, if you genuinely think Andy Dalton gives you a better chance to win than Justin Fields, why did you give up two first-round picks and a fifth and a fourth to go up and get him at pick 11? It doesn't make sense. And so the idea that him and Trey Lance, Mac Jones is a different case because I don't think Mac Jones is a real legitimate starter. Like, I don't think that's a real thing. Like, Mac Jones is a great – I think he's like a third-round prospect, so maybe better than Cam Newton. I know Cam Newton is like a fringe starter at this point, but he feels like a backup-level quarterback. And so with specifically Trey Lance and with Justin Fields, I'm like, well, if you're taking these quarterbacks and you're giving up your future to get them, yeah, you should probably start them. Because if they're not good enough to start, then why are you trading for them? Why are you delaying to the future when your future is this guy? Whether it's Justin Fields or Trey Lance based on your team, I feel like both of them should and need to be starting week one for these teams. Because the thing that's going to ruin Justin Fields is your own organizational incompetence. And with or without him sitting a season, the thing that's going to ruin Justin Fields is Matt Nagy, and it's Matt Nagy and it's Ryan Pace are going to ruin Justin Fields. So if you get them out of the picture, maybe that's the most beneficial thing. I'd argue that when Nagy says sitting Justin Fields is the most beneficial thing, I think the most beneficial thing is you and Ryan Pace going away. That's the most beneficial thing for Justin Fields' career. But I look at those two and I think about all the different circumstances leading up to where we are now and how they got Justin Fields and for the 49ers, how they got Trey Lance. And I've just been so apropos that you need to start a quarterback as soon as they get in there if they are good enough to be a starter, which I think there are four of those this year. Mac Jones is a different case. I don't think Mac Jones is a starting caliber quarterback. He might be the best quarterback on the Patriots, but I don't think he's a starting caliber quarterback. With the rest of these guys, from what we've been told and what draft experts like Blake Jude, who you can check out on the Take It Easy podcast, have said, is that Fields, Lance, Zach Wilson, and Trevor Lawrence can be starting quarterbacks in the NFL. They're first-round prospects. They're top 10 prospects in their class. And if that's the case, start them. There are very few examples you can point to where a guy who was not ready to start right out the gate shouldn't have been starting. We had one last year, Justin Herbert. Justin Herbert, right out the gate, immediately great to start. Tua Tagovailoa played pretty well. And if you argue Ryan Fitzpatrick should have played over him, I don't know what an offseason is going to do for you in terms of the first-team reps. Just give Tua all the first-team reps last year. They didn't do that. Ryan Fitzpatrick did, but also Tua was recovering from injury. And so that delays the process a little bit. But if that's the case, I guess he could have, should have, would have taken Herbert. It's only if you think Herbert is not a first-round prospect that you take Tua over Justin Herbert, looking back in hindsight. But again, hindsight's 20/20, and I don't know what this quarterback class is going to look like. Some people might get ruined. Mac Jones might be awesome. I don't think Mac Jones is a first-round prospect, but I do think pretty adamantly that Justin Fields is good enough to start week one, and it would be the thing that's going to ruin Justin Fields is the Bears' infrastructure, not, as Matt Nagy describes it, when he's not ready to go or not ready to play NFL football. The thing that's going to ruin Justin Fields is the Bears' infrastructure, and if that's the case, maybe sit him a year, miss the playoffs, fire Nagy and Pace, and let the new coach and GM work with Justin Fields. Just saying, that's an entire possibility. It's an entirely real possibility that maybe we aren't giving enough credence to. I don't know. It's an entirely real possibility. I just don't know what the game plan is here for the Chicago Bears. Bear down, Chicago Bears. I just think that all of these guys should be starting week one, to be honest. All four of them. Mac Jones, different case. I have no idea what you do with Mac Jones if I'm the Patriots, because I'm like, I don't think Mac Jones is that good. So I guess we just kind of wait and see what's going to end up being. Everything like people like Blake Jude told me is like, yeah, he's a third-round grade which is kind of where Daniel Jones was. Daniel Jones is kind of a starter. The book is still out on him, but he was graded about the same as Drew Lock. And the book is out that Drew Lock is not a starter. The second-round picks very rarely turn into starters unless they're undervalued, like, for example, Derek Carr or Russell Wilson or Dak Prescott, where just everyone misses on them and they just don't know the evaluation process. So from what I've heard and what we've come to believe is that there's about four first-round quarterbacks this year, and Mac Jones was the fifth one, but Mac Jones could teeter on the edge. So you have Justin Fields, Trey Lance, are the two that people are like, well, we're going to wait and see. But I don't understand what wait and seeing accomplishes. We have this theoretical idea that because they're sitting a year behind these quarterbacks, that they're magically going to absorb all this information and be great. But sometimes it's as simple as Paxton Lynch couldn't beat out Trevor Siemian for the starting job. And sometimes it's as simple as Jared Goff was the third stringer because he wasn't ready to be the quarterback of the Rams. And although Jared Goff turned it around in the scheme, it's pretty clear Jared Goff is not the quarterback that we thought he was going to be at one. And to be honest, might have been ruined a little bit by the Jeff Fisher scheme. And so I don't think sitting accomplishes very much. I think sitting is not a guarantee for success. I even think sometimes it will lead to failure. I think sitting a quarterback can lead to a derailing of said quarterback's future. So I don't understand the whole idea of sitting a quarterback. It can lead to, like, the Texans getting obsessed with it and starting T.J. Yates for half a game over Deshaun Watson, or the Bills starting Nathan Peterman over Josh Allen for half a game. It's just a weird infatuation that I think all rookie quarterbacks should be starting week one. Just because they're sitting on the bench, it might be a sign if some of these guys are sitting on the bench. Just saying. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for stopping in to the Take It Easy radio show. Thanks again to everyone stopping in on YouTube as well. Make sure to subscribe there. Leave some comments. Leave some thoughts. It's always much appreciated. And we are going to be off till next week, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for stopping in over these last 2 days here on the Take It Easy radio show. If you want some more content from us, follow on Comical Sports Memes and Take It Easy Podcast on Instagram. And check out all the work that we continue to do. You guys continue to support us. And if you're listening to us here, you also support the good work over at Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. So check all of that great work out. There's a lot of cool stuff going on all around us. So until next time, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for stopping in here today, and take it easy. Hope you've enjoyed our little talk show here. We'll chat next week. Check out the podcast. Take it easy.